Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with Donald Trump's naming of the Attorney General of Oklahoma, Scott Pruitt, as the next head of the EPA, and speak with a leading expert on energy and environmental issues who helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. David Freeman, a senior advisor to Friends of the Earth, who headed up the Tennessee Valley Authority, New York Power, and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and is the author of All Electric Future, A Climate Solution and the Hopeful Future, joins us to discuss the cynical choice of an aggressive anti-environmentalist to head up an agency meant to protect the land, air, and water. As Oklahoma's Attorney General, Scott Pruitt, a protege of Oklahoma's global warming denying Senator James Imhoff, has spent most of his time suing the EPA on behalf of fossil fuel companies and shale oil fracking outfits who have turned Oklahoma into the earthquake capital of the United States. Then we'll speak with Anthea Butler, a professor of religious studies and graduate chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. She is on a McCarthyite hit list funded by a right-wing billionaire that targets academics who they consider subversive, which results in an organized blizzard of hate mail and demands for resignation sent to university chancellors, deans, and students to get professors fired. She joins us to discuss her article at The Guardian, I'm on the Professor Watch List, It's a Ploy to Undermine Free Speech, and the Orwellian nature of reporting on professors by students who, in the name of fighting bias, are encouraged by groups like Turning Point USA and Campus Reform to be informants rather than enter into dialogue and discourse with those who have differing opinions. Then finally, we'll look into the continuing fallout from Donald Trump's call to the leader of Taiwan, with the New York Times revealing that Senator Bob Dole, a lobbyist for Taiwan, helped arrange the call that has China fuming and many wondering whether it is a sign of incompetence and amateurism or if there is some kind of strategy at work. An expert on Taiwan, Shelley Rigger, a professor of political science at Davidson College and author of Why Taiwan Matters, Small Island, Global Powerhouse, joins us to try to make sense of where relations between the U.S. and China might be heading amid mixed and contradictory signals from the new Trump administration. And joining us now is David Freeman, who's a senior advisor with the Friends of the Earth Nuclear Campaign and a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He has had the ear of federal officials since the days of JFK and helped to bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under Jimmy Carter and also headed New York Power and the Los Angeles Department of Water and Power, and was the California State Energy Czar responsible for rescuing California from the predations of Enron and Company. He's the author of Winning Our Energy Independence, and Energy Insider shows how. And his latest book is All Electric Future, A Climate Solution and the Hopeful Future. Welcome to Background Briefing, David Freeman.
Well, I'm glad to be with you, although the news is not really very good.
No. Well, that's going to ask you. Talk about a hopeful future when you've got another Dracula in charge of the blood bank, in the case of the EPA with Scott Pruitt, the Attorney General of the state of Oklahoma, heading it up. He's a dedicated fracker, which is the state of Oklahoma has had more earthquakes lately than it's ever had in its geological history. And he's a protege of the great climate denier, Senator James Imhoff of Oklahoma. So is there anything hopeful we can say about this man?
Not about this man. Or all we can say is we've got to recognize that the federal government just dropped dead on us as far as the challenge of climate and the environment. And I think we have to rely on the states and individuals and a campaign to retake the federal government. You know, when you've taken a licking, the least you can do is to face up to the fact that you've taken a licking and get up and try to fight back and re-examine what the environmental movement is doing right and what it's doing wrong. I take this rather personally because I was in the Nixon administration as a staff person in the White House, and along with a fellow named Doug Kostel, we actually helped the Ash Council, which was reorganizing the government, decide on an independent environmental protection agency. We ended up being backed up by John Ehrlichman, who was sort of delegated this area by the president. And the big fight really was whether it should be part of the Department of Interior. But we were lucky, and the president didn't much like Wally Hickel anyhow, and got rid of him later on. And so we succeeded in making the EPA independent, and it was supposed to be strong and the environmental protector without fear or favor. And interestingly enough, it became law through a reorganization plan. There was a statute on the books then that if the president sent up a reorganization plan, if Congress didn't vote no in 30 days, it became law. And that's how EPA became an agency. But it was the creature of Richard Nixon, and it was strong. The first administrator was James Ruckelshaus, and he ordered the utilities to build scrubbers to clean up the emission of coal from local pollution. We were not sufficiently aware of the climate issue then. The fight was coal dust and sulfur oxide and issues like that. And the EPA, in modern days, you could say that Bernie Sanders was running it. Under Richard Nixon, it was a strong, hard-hitting agency that told the electric power industry what to do. There was no cap-and-trade or tax incentive approach for any of that stuff. It was just straight orders, best available technology, do it, damn it. And that was what happened. That's how the air got cleaned up sufficiently in Los Angeles and elsewhere in California, where people could actually go out and jog and breathe. So we have, this is a Republican agency that started its life off very, very strong and successful, and has succeeded in making the air reasonably breathable in the big cities. It's a success story. And now we put a denier in charge of it. It kind of breaks your heart, and that's kind of my reaction.
And again, I'm speaking with David Freeman, who's a senior advisor with Friends of the Earth Nuclear Campaign and a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He has had the ear of federal officials since the days of JFK and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under Jimmy Carter and also headed New York Power and Los Angeles DWP, and was the state energy czar responsible for rescuing California from the predations of Enron and company. And he's the author of Winning Our Energy Independence, and Energy Insider shows how. And his latest book is All Electric Future, A Climate Solution and the Hopeful Future. But in terms of Scott Pruitt, the Attorney General of the state of Oklahoma, I know it's heartbreaking to have these kind of people who are very much, I mean, dedicated in a zealous way against the very mission of the government department that they have been nominated to by the president, in this case, Donald Trump. So that going in. But this guy has his record as the Attorney General of Oklahoma. He spent most of his time suing the EPA, the very agency that he's going to be heading up. He's been suing them to deny Americans the benefit of reducing mercury, arsenic, and other toxins in the air that we breathe, cutting smog that causes asthma, and protecting our wetlands, etc. He has sued the federal government for regulating pollution in rivers under the Waters of the United States rule, and so forth. And he's been a huge champion of fracking, which the state of Oklahoma is all of a sudden having more earthquakes than anywhere else on the planet. And they've never had them before in their past. And, of course, he's a protege of James Imhoff, the senator who is the most vociferous global warming denier. So it's not like you got a global warming denier. It's worse than that. You got a proactive anti-environmental guy in there.
Well, I think that this underscores a lesson that people throughout the country, and especially in Michigan and other states, need to understand that elections have consequences. We elected a president who came out and said that climate change is a hoax, and now he's put in charge a person that's anti-doing anything, in charge of the agency that's got the job of doing something. So we're getting the government that we elected, and I think the only thing to do is to recognize that the only way to change this situation is at the ballot box. And therefore, everyone that has any concern about the about their grandchildren, about the fact that we now face a threat that's not local anymore, it's global, and in a very real way, the only house we live in, Mother Earth, is on fire. Instead of putting a fireman in charge of the fire department, we put an arsonist. And, you know, the only way to change that is to throw the rascals out and elect some people that will implement the will of the people to survive. And that's going to require a much tougher advocacy on the part of the so-called environmental community. Quite frankly, I think that there's some responsibility that has to be taken by the environmental organizations and the Democratic Party that really have not been very vigorous in advocating measures that would really reduce the emission of greenhouse gases. Ever since the cap-and-trade bill died about 5-6 years ago, we just assumed that nothing could be done, and the measures that have been suggested by President Obama, in my view, were very weak and would have very little impact on actually doing what the climatologists tell us. We have got to reduce greenhouse gas emissions across the board 3% a year starting now, or we're going to cook. That's what the family doctor, the climatologist, is saying. And without the kind of vigorous attempt to pass laws, it's not going to happen. Why has the Democratic platform not had a provision in there that all new electric power plants have to be renewable? Why are we doing nothing but just observing the fact that we burn more gasoline this year than any time in our history? We've got to tell Detroit that they've got to stop making gas-guzzling cars and start making entirely greenhouse gas-free electric vehicles or fuel cell vehicles. I mean, we've got to start advocating some laws that will make it happen. See, this country has not made the fundamental decision that the climate crisis requires us to actually do things and not just talk about them. We don't treat it as the equivalent of World War III, which it is. We don't act as though our house is on fire and we got to start putting it out right now. It's not hard to go to Paris and say 50 years from now or 30 years from now, we're going to do this and that with no enforcement and no mechanism for doing it this year, next year, and the year after. And the whole Obama Clean Power Program deals only with the electric power sector, which is one-third of the greenhouse gases, and we need to substitute renewable electricity for oil and gas in our transportation and in our heating and across the board if we're going to win this fight. So I think those of us on the positive side need to reexamine whether we're offering the Bernie Sanders crowd anything worth fighting for. And we've got to develop such a platform and the leadership to advance it. And so crying and bellyaching about what is happening, they promised us this, and they're doing it. Now, we've got to keep our promise to the future generation by coming up with a program that will actually get the job done and fighting for it.
Well, what do you think, though, Dave Freeman, is going on with these mixed signals from Donald Trump, where he had Al Gore visit him a couple of days ago, and then just today we learned that we have this Scott Pruitt, the AG of Oklahoma, this aggressive anti-environmentalist, the head of...
Well, you're in the business. You know what he's doing. The Apprentice show is going on.
Right.
He is a He's as good as you are, Ian, at attracting attention.
Well, maybe
even a little better.
I think he is, yeah. I haven't become president of the United States lately, so I'm way behind him.
Of course, he knows what will get you to talk about him.
Right.
And you're going to be talking about him for the next 4 years if he has his way. He will, you know, if you eliminate facts and you can just deal in fantasy and emotional reactions and you're good at it, and this show is going to go on for 4 years.
Right. Well, it is government by stunt. Every other day he has a different stunt, whether it's Carrier, whether it's canceling the Boeing contract, whether it's having this Japanese billionaire hold up a piece of paper saying he's going to invest $50 billion and create 50,000 jobs. It's one stunt after the other. But I'm wondering, though, with the Al Gore situation, whether he's deliberately humiliating people like Al Gore and Mitt Romney. Is that what's going on?
I think that he is deliberately drawing attention to himself on an hourly basis. I've never seen anyone that needed attention more than this man. And he needs it not just every once in a while, not just every day. He needs it all the time. And that's what's going on. Al's a Boy Scout. He's a patriot. He got an invitation from Trump's daughter to come, and he's going to be there. And I'm not saying that it was completely disingenuous, and he did meet with Trump, but Trump is a showman, and he's very good at it. But the action is what he did at EPA today. How can you possibly square a conversation with Al Gore one day, a column this morning by Friedman in the New York Times expressing hope, and then a few hours later, he names essentially the Koch brothers in charge of the EPA.
Right. Well, you know, one of the hopeful things about the millennials and the young religious people on the right is that they're also concerned about environmentalism in a kind of Christian context, of being stewards of the earth, of God's gift. But, you know, unfortunately, this guy, Pruitt, he's very religious. He serves as a deacon of the First Baptist Church of Broken Arrow in Oklahoma and is a trustee of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary. But he's one of those people like James Watt that somehow have distorted the Bible, which implores us or exhorts us to be stewards of the earth, as opposed to it's all there up for grabs, you know.
Well, did you see the sermon that Jimmy Carter gave at Sunday school the Sunday after Trump got elected? He said the essence of Christianity is to love the people you hate. That's a challenge for you, Ian.
Well, I'll take that challenge up with Stephen Bannon. He's a professional hater, so we'll see whether I can turn him into a pussycat.
But the most vigorous, successful Christian I know is Jimmy Carter. And these guys, they're not practicing Jimmy Carter's brand of Christianity. Not that I can see. I mean, love thy neighbor. He's saying, I don't want any neighbors. He's saying, you know, we're putting walls up. We're not welcoming strangers. We ought to kick them out if they look a bit strange. I mean, this is an anti-Christian philosophy as far as I can tell. But, you know, you can say religion is something that you believe in, and you can't argue with anyone's religion. They just believe it. But that doesn't necessarily square with reality.
Well, just in closing, David Freeman, short of continuing to recycle and to be virtuous as much as we can in these small ways, do you have a kind of, apart from getting your latest book, The All-Electric Future, A Climate Solution and the Hopeful Future, is there any kind of marching orders, any action plan you can leave us with?
Yeah, put your money where your mouth is. I just had a meeting with one of the investment houses today. I'm going to spend my time trying to persuade people with money to invest in solar, wind, and clean energy and not invest in fossil fuels. I think that if we can, if the battle is going to be on the in the marketplace, we have invented a better mousetrap. The solar and wind technology that we now have is the modern equivalent of the steam engine. It is a point in history that we haven't recognized yet. This stuff is cheaper than oil and gas and nuclear power, and if we can invigorate investors to recognize that, in other words, anybody in the oil industry has got to be economically foolish to continue drilling for oil, because they have no assurance that 10 or 15 years from now they'll even be able to burn it. And frankly, more and more we're finding that we can utilize renewable electricity to substitute for oil and gas. This revolution can't be stopped, but it needs to be accelerated so that we put the fire out before our house burns down. But I have no doubt that we have invented in the last several years the modern equivalent of the steam engine. We have a new source of energy that is actually free and everlasting, and the only cost is the machines that we have to build to use it, who are going to get cheaper and cheaper as time goes on, and where they already can be depreciated over a number of years and give us energy is cheap or cheaper than oil, gas, or nuclear. So that's the good news, but we've got to move it, because Adam Smith is a lazy fella, and we're not, you know, but I think that we can make a difference that way. But in the final analysis, we got to pass a bunch of laws. We have to pass a Railroad Electrification Act, just like we brought electricity to rural America. We need to electrify the railroads all over the country and get the trucks off the road altogether. And we need to require that the automobile companies in a few years from now start making only electric cars, and that every home has a heat pump, not an oil furnace or electric furnace. We have the technology to cure this climate problem and save money in the process. And so I do think we need to accelerate our efforts to try to sell this to people that have money to invest and to companies that are investing, and try to fan the flames of this revolution so that it moves fast enough to save us.
Right. So, and meanwhile, the Chinese are not sitting on their hands with green energy. So,
No, the Chinese will have a free fuel energy economy in 2050, and they'll beat the stuffings out of us economically if we don't have one to match it.
Well, David Freeman, I thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with David Freeman, who's a senior advisor with Friends of the Earth Nuclear Campaign and a leading authority on the production, management, and delivery of energy to large populations. He's had the ear of federal officials since the days of JFK and helped bring about the Environmental Protection Agency under President Nixon. He headed the Tennessee Valley Authority under Jimmy Carter and also headed New York Power and the Los Angeles DWP, and was the state energy's responsible for rescuing California from the predations of Enron and Company, and is the author of Winning Our Energy Independence and Energy Insight. Shows how, and his latest book is All Electric Future, A Climate Solution and the Hopeful Future. We're going to take a brief station break and we're back talking to a professor who is on the McCarthyite hit list funded by a right-wing billionaire that targets academics. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Anthea Butler, who's a professor of religious studies and graduate chair in the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Her latest book is The Gospel According to Sarah, How Sarah Palin and the Tea Party Are Galvanizing the Religious Right. And she has an article at The Guardian, I'm on the Professor Watch List. It's a ploy to undermine free speech. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anthea Butler.
Thank you, Ian.
And that's a dubious honor to be on the professor's watch list. It sounds a bit like Richard Nixon's enemies list. Tell us about it.
It does. Well, this professor watch list was put together by an organization funded by a right-wing billionaire, which it's supposed to be watching professors who ostensibly are either teaching things in the classroom that are not up to conservative values, or are somehow, as I put it, seditious in some kind of way. And I think it's just a little bit, I wouldn't say it's McCarthyite, but it's getting very close.
And what are their tactics, though? Because it's not just a question of a list. Don't they try and essentially blacken the name of people and hurt their academic careers by having emails blasted to the deans and the chancellors and the students, et cetera? So tell me about their methodology.
Yeah, I'm happy to. The organization that's doing this is Turning Point USA. And basically what Turning Point and other things like Campus Reform, other organizations like that, they are designed to sort of train your students in a way, at least conservative students that want to be trained this way, how to watch out for professors who, you know, say things that maybe show a liberal bias or something like that. So in a couple of instances, I have been smeared by these things. One was after an article I wrote for Religion Dispatches about the George Zimmerman acquittal, and I referenced a book from 1972 called God is a Right Racist. And in the context of the article, I was sort of positing, you know, part of having a philosophical conversation about this, and they said, oh, she called God a white racist, and, you know, God with capital G. And so that ensued all of these phone calls and, you know, people screaming for my head at the University of Pennsylvania. So these kinds of events, when these organizations like Turning Point or this Professor's Watch List or Campus Reform, you know, decide that they want to go after somebody, they take something that might be innocuous to our students because we're you know, discussing something or in an academic setting, and they twist it to make it sound as though you're teaching really awful things and trying to turn young minds. And that kind of, I think it's very Orwellian. I also think that it's problematic because it's getting into people can decide what they need to say and what they don't need to say. And it's a violation of my free speech rights. And I don't go around trying to tell them what they can say. So why are they trying to censor me?
Well, what's particularly odd in your case is that you teach courses on the religious right.
Exactly.
And you actually introduce your students to the propaganda, or I guess we could call it the preaching, of the religious right. And you encourage them to attend conferences like CPAC and the Value Voters Summit, et cetera, that the religious right put on. So you're just using their words and video of them to evaluate,
yeah,
to have your students evaluate. You're actually doing them a favor.
I know I am. I mean, that's the funny part is that I don't really think they know who I am, and they don't know what I do. They just think somehow if you talk about race, you're a racist, and so you must be the racist because you talk about race. It's this kind of crazy circle where everybody's trying to chase their tail. But my students, when they come to my religious right class, get to learn about CPAC, and they would know more about Mike Pence and other you know, figures that we're seeing in this new administration than most people, because I have my students spend time learning this history from Roe v. Wade forward, or even earlier than that. So I think, you know, this is really funny to me that I'm on a professor watch list and I actually, you know, talk about them. And so maybe I bear watching because I'm teaching about, you know, what Breitbart and other organizations are doing.
And again, I'm speaking with Anthea Butler, who is a professor of religious studies and graduate chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Her latest book is The Gospel According to Sarah, How Sarah Palin and the Tea Party Are Galvanizing the Religious Right. And she has an article at The Guardian, I'm on the Professor Watch List. It's a ploy to undermine free speech. I must say, though, you know, you talk about Bannon and his influence over this administration and Mike Pence, his very, very deep ties to the religious right. Things are moving very fast. And I must say, every time I, in the morning, pick up the New York Times and the LA Times, I feel like I'm getting my daily dose of doom. This is really turning into a very dark place, the zeitgeist in this country. And when you think about some of the, I mean, I know you can't, you can't necessarily connect the dots. But, for example, the shooting of the young football star down in Louisiana by this white guy who had had road rage incidents before and who shot this unarmed African-American guy who cut him off in traffic or the other way around, and nobody quite knows. But he shot him dead and was released. And then subsequently, after a tremendous outcry from the citizenry, they finally arrested this guy. But the idea that they let him walk was just incomprehensible. And then you have the jury down in South Carolina, hung jury because one of the jurors would not convict a policeman, even though the video evidence made it clear that he shot this African-American man in the back. He was running away, shot him a whole bunch of times. It's absolutely graphic and unimpeachable. I know you can't make a case out of those anecdotes, but it just feels to me like all the sort of ugly stuff that's been under the surface in this country festering for decades, if not centuries, has now been given permission to come out into the sunlight.
Yeah, I think it's really important to take a long historical lens on this, because as I tell people before, it's like there's nothing new that we're seeing now, except for the fact that everybody thought that the election of a black president made us post-racial. It didn't. It made us, you know, it made some people, at least, as one of my friends put it, go into a paroxysm of racist, you know, screeds, and they haven't stopped. I think that, you know, both of these cases say something about where we might be going, and I hate to say this, but I do think that the problem is now, because of the past election cycle and the ways in which race was spoken about by the Republican candidate, I think that we're going to be in a time period where there will be a tremendous backlash against African Americans, against Latinos, against anybody who's an immigrant or a Muslim. And all these people are being othered up against white Anglo-Saxon Protestantism. And as a religion scholar, this troubles me because I know what kinds of things we get into when that happens. You end up vilifying other people. You don't understand what this country was made of to begin with. And everybody seems to think that unless you do what the police says, that you just have to be a law-abiding citizen and everything is going to be all right. Well, we know that's not true. We know it's not true. And so I think now what we're faced with is a real threat to the democratic process here in this country. And I think that well-meaning people need to start to think about what that might mean and awake from their slumber, because there are things that are even being put in place right now that I think threaten the very thing that the founding fathers wanted to do.
Well, is there any way to build a movement, do you think? Are we going to have a kind of, Newton's law of thermodynamics? For every action, there's an equal and opposite reaction. What does it take? I mean, one of the problems with that kind of thinking, you know, it goes back to that old sort of Marxist axiom of if you give the capitalists enough rope, they'll hang themselves. Well, so far, the capitalists are doing incredibly well. The 1% or the 1% are just, and by the way, they've just been given a blank check by Donald Trump, and they're going to get even richer now for the next 4 years. They'll be even doing better than they've done over the last couple of decades, where they've been the only winners. So it's a crazy situation, but, and I don't believe that necessarily that you do get the kind of reaction that you need to counteract this drift. But perhaps you can tell me something a little more optimistic. I don't want to be feeding on the daily dose of doom.
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to be optimistic. I mean, I was telling somebody that I thought, I said, look, you know, look at what just happened in South Korea with the Korean president. She had been listening to the shamanistic woman, and everybody, the country found out. And they have been in the streets protesting. And people were in the streets the first week right after the election. I think what's going to happen is that things might need to get worse. And what I mean by that is that I could see something happening that is actually a combination of two things. One is, you know, on the Democratic side, or maybe independents or liberals who don't like what has happened in this election, is trying to mobilize. And right now, it doesn't look very promising, okay? And I have to be honest about that. It doesn't look promising. The Democrats can't even get themselves together to get a, you know, a good DNC chair for the party. And it, you know, and I don't see President Obama doing anything except trying to hope this transition works out well. Maybe he'll be different afterwards. I do think the thing that might be very interesting is that what is the moment that all of the Trump supporters become disillusioned with him? And I would place a bet that that is going to be sooner rather than later, because there are already the rumblings now about all these appointees. Sarah Palin herself said, you know, accused him of crony capitalism. He's doing things much like his Wall Street buddies and businessmen, all the things that he accused Hillary Clinton of doing. And so I think that it may not come from liberals necessarily. It may come from, you know, the party, the Republican Party imploding on itself, and the people who once again were suckered into voting for somebody who didn't have their best interests in mind revolting against him.
Well, I must say it's pretty transparent what he's up to. What he's up to is government by stunt. He has a stunt which the press dutifully cover, like the carrier, where he was delivering on a promise which he made. And by the way, he did promise to try and help working class and middle class Americans get their jobs back. And Hillary Clinton didn't even talk to them. So you've got to give him credit for that. But still, the carrier thing was a stunt. And then then he has another stunt where he cancels the Boeing contract for a new Air Force One. And then he has another stunt where he has this Japanese mogul beside him holding up a piece of paper promising $50 billion investment and 50,000 jobs. So that, to me, smacks of bread and circuses. I don't see any policies, any coherence, and I don't think there is with a guy that tweets at 3 a.m., But he's a showman, and he's putting on a show. So I guess the question will be, when will people wake up to the bread and circuses, and how long can you govern by stunt?
I don't know how long you can. He's gone on for, what has it been, 16, 18 months of the campaign, and then he won. Well, you know, he won because of the Electoral College. He didn't win by the popular vote. We have to remember that he knows he's not going in with a mandate because he's down almost 3 million votes. So he got the right votes, he just didn't get all of the votes. So we have to continually remind him of that. That's number one. I think that it will take about a year that the stunts will run out, because it's very clear that his attention span is very low. And I don't know that he'll be able to keep up the stunts, because the people who he's put in office are going to want to govern a certain kind of way. And they're going to want to control whatever little piece of the pie they have, whether that's HUD or education or something like that. And he's not going to be able to manage all these moving pieces. That's pretty clear. The question is, will Pence be managing them? Will Bannon be managing them? Who will really be in charge? Who's really going to run things? And I think that's the bigger question, because to be honest, you know, Donald Trump is sort of, you know, he's P.T. Barnum with not good intent. He, you know, he knows that there's a sucker born every minute, and he's going to try to, you know, do all he can to get everything he can. And I think that's about the Trump empire. For everyone else, these people are serious, and they're serious about, you know, conservative governance, and they're serious about making money, and they're serious about taking away health care, taking away money for education and killing the public schools. They're serious about a lot of things that could crater our country. And I think those are the ones who we really need to be watching out for. And the press needs to do its job and stop reporting on the 3 a.m. tweets.
Well, the press were unable to get him to reveal his taxes. They never asked him about why he didn't serve in the Vietnam War. As we know, Bill Clinton got pounded over that, and so did George W. Bush. They have not really laid a glove on him. And in fact, what's happened in the meantime is that Stephen Bannon and Peter Thiel, the Silicon Valley mogul, have helped, you know, spread and proliferate fake news, all of which has been detrimental to Hillary Clinton and helpful to Donald Trump.
And we could have an entire Putin-esque kind of regime information situation for the next 4 years.
I think we will.
Because these guys are real clever. They have strategy. They're quite evil. And Bannon himself, in an interview with the Hollywood Reporter, said how much he admires the power of the dark side, of the Darth Vaders and the Dick Cheneys of the world. And they've used that incredibly successfully. And that's my fear, is that they've got a lot of tools in their toolbox, and they're ruthless. Our side, if you want to be partisan, their side is ruthless. Our side is gutless. Our side doesn't have a strategy. Their side does.
Yes, no, that's exactly right. And they've been planning this strategy for a long time. And even if you just take, let me use Bannon as an example with Breitbart, you know, with Andrew Breitbart, and he took over that. I think that one of the things that everybody's missed is that for the last, you know, since 2008, these news sites, you know, like Breitbart and Newsmax and all of these other things, they were the feeders to Fox. I mean, it's not Fox creating this news. Fox actually just reports what all these other sites that are underneath it say. And so there's an ecosystem about how this news gets out and how fake news gets out. And it's been generated for a long time. And I think that now people are just starting to pay attention to it, but it's too late because all of it is very together and it's very coordinated.
Right, and they've got an amazing product, which is the presidency of the United States, that breaks news all the time.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, I thank you for joining us, Anthea. I wish we could end on a more positive note. As I say, we're adding to the daily dose of doom here, but presumably the pendulum will swing back at some point.
Let's hope so.
I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Anthea Butler, who's a professor of religious studies and graduate chair of the Department of Religious Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. Her latest book is The Gospel According to Sarah, How Sarah Palin and the Tea Party Are Galvanizing the Religious Right. And she has an article at The Guardian, I'm on the Professor Watch List. It's a ploy to undermine free speech. We're going to take a brief station break and back looking into the continuing fallout from Donald Trump's call to the leader of Taiwan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Shelley Rigger, who is an expert on Taiwan. She's a professor of political science at Davidson College, where she focuses on East Asian politics, and she's testified before Congress and advised members of Congress on U.S.-Taiwan relations. She's the author of Why Taiwan Matters, Small Island Global Powerhouse. Welcome to Background Briefing, Shelley Rigger.
Thank you very much.
And the New York Times is carrying a story on Wednesday on the front page suggesting that former Senator Bob Dole, former Republican presidential candidate, played a role in Donald Trump's call to Taiwan that caused such a ruckus. So I guess, you know, it's still a little murky, but I guess the question that's hanging out there is there some strategy involved in this, or is this about economic ties?
Yeah, I think really I'm sure that the Bob Dole's organization, right, his lobbying outfit, was one of the players who helped put forward the idea of a phone call, but I don't think it's by any means the only, and I'm kind of skeptical that it's even the major force behind this. There are lots and lots of people in Washington and outside of Washington who have been arguing for a long time that it makes sense for U.S. officials to talk to officials in Taiwan, especially if once they take office, they are going to not be able to speak directly to counterparts in Taiwan. So, you know, there are plenty of folks out there who have been arguing for a long time that someone in Trump's position, a president-elect or a presidential candidate, should seize the opportunity before taking office to have such a conversation. So, you know, the fact that Bob Dole wants to take credit might be as much about Bob Dole hoping to solicit more business through this great success as it is about Bob Dole actually being the critical voice making it happen.
Well, I'm told that also John Bolton was in Trump Tower and in the room when that call either came in or was made. And as you know, Donald Trump said, she called me to congratulate me in Taiwan. Everybody in the press there and the government's saying quite the opposite. So we don't really know about the motives here. But I guess the way it's framed is it was either ineptitude or some kind of clever strategy that we're not yet aware of. And that's pretty much the question I'm posing for you.
Okay, well, what I would say is the phone call was probably clever strategy. And this is a question that people who, you know, pay very close attention to U.S.-Taiwan PRC relations all the time have been debating for years is what should U.S. officials do, how much interaction communication should they have, and what form should it take, and so on. So I think that there's definitely every reason to believe that the phone call itself was the product of careful calculation and planning. And I am quite confident that there's no way Tsai Ing-wen, the president of Taiwan, would have placed such a call without absolute certainty that it was a welcome development. So I think that they arranged all of that ahead of time. And I think there is a case to be made that having such a phone call was actually a good idea. What was not a good idea and what has kind of caused the whole interaction to become very negative were Trump's tweets after the phone call attracted some criticism from the media.
So accepting that the premise that it was clever strategy, what is the strategy?
So the strategy is this is a really important relationship that the U.S. has with Taiwan, that Taiwan is a major economic partner, but also a significant security partner of the U.S., even though we do not have formal diplomatic relations, much less some kind of military alliance with Taiwan. But we do have a security relationship, and we value Taiwan's example and its presence as a democratic, a liberal democratic friend in Northeast Asia. So, but for the last 40 years or so, U.S. presidents have not been able to communicate directly with their counterparts in Taiwan because the U.S. has this policy of saying our relationship with Taiwan is unofficial. So U.S. officials will not have direct communication at a high level with Taiwanese officials. So the strategy would be to say, okay, maybe we can't talk after the inauguration, but during this kind of liminal moment, you know, where Trump is not yet president, he could have a direct interaction and establish a rapport and some trust with the Taiwanese president. And I think that's certainly from the Taiwanese point of view, what is desirable about having a conversation is knowing that there's a little thread linking these two human beings and that, you know, once the inauguration in the U.S. takes place and Trump is a little bit more constrained in what he can do, then that thread can hold the two sides together. So that would be the strategy. And there's another element, too, which may be that, and I think this is, I'm less confident of this because, again, the Trump transition has been very, shall we say, inscrutable so far. But it's possible that Trump's advisors on Asia policy are imagining that they will change the policy to make it, to perhaps even suspend this injunction against U.S. officials speaking to Taiwan counterparts at a high level. Maybe they were signaling that as well.
And again, I'm speaking with Shelley Rigger, who's an expert on Taiwan. She's a professor of political science at Davidson College, where she focuses on East Asian politics, and she's testified before Congress and advised members of Congress on U.S.-Taiwan relations. And she's the author of Why Taiwan Matters, Small Island Global Powerhouse. So is there anything, though, beyond what you've just told us? For example, yesterday, Donald Trump made an announcement with a Japanese tycoon who promised $50 billion and 50,000 jobs. But he also mentioned a deal with Foxconn, which is a huge operation in China. They make all the iPhones, et cetera. But it is a Taiwanese company on the mainland, is it not?
Yes, it is. And it's a big Taiwanese company in Taiwan as well. And I think what you're pointing to here is one of the reasons why these incidents or, you know, the Trump's behavior in the last few days with respect to East Asia policy are so destabilizing and controversial, which is we just don't know. You know, we don't know. I just made a case to you for why the phone call could be a good idea, but I can't defend the tweets at all. I think the tweets are a disaster. The question that I can't answer is, were the tweets part of the strategy, or is that just Trump being Trump? Similarly, I can't really say with any confidence whether what appear to be economic entanglements and conflicts of interest matter in this picture, or whether they are kind of incidental. You know, so there's a Japanese business tycoon seizing an opportunity to get his picture taken with Donald Trump and to, you know, exchange favors with this president-elect. Will that influence U.S. policy? It's really hard to say, but I think the uncertainty about that and the possibility, even the possibility that the United States president might put economic interests that are, you know, his own economic interests and his own political interests ahead of U.S. national interests, just the fact that the question can even be asked is very destabilizing to a lot of people in the United States and around the world.
Well, of course, nobody thought that the emolument sections of the U.S. Constitution would ever they've been gathering dust for hundreds of years. And sadly now we're concerned that he's taking money from foreign potentates, you know, as the founding fathers were nervous about back in the days of the Constitution. But let's just in the last few minutes then talk about the possibility of a strategy here, because clearly the TPP, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, was and Obama's pivot to Asia was meant, one, to get us out of the quagmires in the Middle East and to deal with the rising superpower of China. And the TPP was, in a way, I think, more of a geostrategic deal than it was a trade deal, but it's pretty much been scuttled by isolationists on the right and anti-globalists on the left. So it's dead in the water, but the idea of organizing the neighborhood against China, it's not difficult to do because a lot of the neighborhood is nervous. And if you put together South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, in the Philippines and Malaysia and Vietnam and Indonesia, you begin to see the picture, right?
Yes, except that I don't see, without TPP, what is in this deal for the neighbors, right? So the Philippines, under Duterte, seems already to have chosen a different path, right, cast their lot with China rather than with the U.S. I'm not sure that that is a durable switch, but it is certainly, for the moment, it looks like the Philippines has made its decision. And South Korea is a mess at the moment. Japan will decide whether or not the U.S. is a reliable ally. And Trump has said many things that if I were the Japanese prime minister, I would wonder whether the U.S. would be a reliable ally to Japan. So, you know, I think for many of the leaders in the region, the one thing they know for sure is the best chance for uniting the region in a kind of positive and win-win way, which was a trade agreement, is dead. What Trump will actually do about security arrangements is an open question. The only thing we know is that he's not going to help them out on the economic front. And, you know, for the Trump camp to turn around and advertise itself as a great friend of Taiwan after scuttling the TPP is just shocking, really, because TPP was the great hope, and continues to be, actually, the great hope for Taiwan's reintegration into the global economy. And so, you know, I just don't see how you can square that circle.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, do you think the other part of Trump's promises, campaign promises, was not a promise, but a threat, in effect, of a trade war? Where do you see that?
I think that's also a possibility. You know, it's very the signals out of Camp Trump are incredibly contradictory. So on the one hand, he has said within the last couple of days, including here in my home state of North Carolina, you know, trade is war. But then today he named a pro-trade ag state governor as his ambassador to China, someone who has a long, long, long relationship with Xi Jinping and whose state benefits massively from trade with China. So what are we to make of this? If there is a strategy, it is a very confusing one indeed.
Well, Shelley Rigger, I guess we'll both stay tuned, and I thank you for joining us.
You're very welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Shelley Rigger, who's an expert on Taiwan. She's a professor of political science at Davidson College, where she focuses on East Asian politics and has testified before Congress and advised members of Congress on U.S.-Taiwan relations, and is the author of Why Taiwan Matters, Small Island, Global Powerhouse. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me and scroll down the right-hand side and sign up to iTunes podcast. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.
Standing along the side of the pickup truck, a shot rang out in the night, just when everything seemed right, another headline written down. Bye.